From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. And here are the issues. President Obama announced an American-led military plan to, quote, destroy, unquote, the Islamic State terrorist group that has taken over one-third of Iraq. But Arab and European leaders initially offered tepid support for the effort. In Brussels, American and European officials agreed on new economic sanctions on Russia over its role in aiding a separatist movement in Ukraine and in Scotland. Voters will decide on September 18th whether to secede from the United Kingdom and become an independent country. Well, Stephen, let me start with you. The president gave a speech to the nation on television and announced a coalition that would join the United States in this effort to defeat and destroy, a strong word for the president when he talks about destroying the Islamic State or ISIS, I-S-I-S. And he announced a broad coalition, but there really isn't one yet.
Right. I think there were two purposes of this speech. The first one was to sort of stop the political bleeding for the president. He'd had a series of clumsy appearances, one of which he said a couple of weeks ago that he had not yet a strategy to take on Islamic State in Syria. And the political sense, it may have stilled some nerves in the White House, and it made at least look like the president has a coherent plan for taking on Islamic State. But the wider perspective, the question of whether this can actually work, I think is much more problematic. You mentioned that a number of countries, according to the White House at least, have signed up for this coalition, but it doesn't appear that many of them are actually that intent on doing very much. Mm-hmm. For example, in the Arab world, Turkey is very concerned about which has a long border with Syria, across which a lot of these ISIS foreign fighters flow, is very concerned about the fate of 49 of its diplomats, which are held hostage by ISIS. It doesn't want to do anything too public. Even in Europe, it seems uncertain, at least, exactly who is going to help the United States bomb ISIS in Syria. Yesterday, mm-hmm. there was this spectacle in the UK of the British foreign minister coming out and saying, well, we're not going to take part in any airstrikes on Syria. An hour later, 2 hours later, perhaps after a slightly worried call from the White House to Downing Street, the Prime mm-hmm. Minister's spokesman came out and said, well, David Cameron hasn't decided about that yet. Mm-hmm. If this is a coalition, there are real cracks in it.
Mm-hmm. I think Germany said the same thing, that Germany will not take part in any
right.
actual military actions.
Right. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, although the United States has got the military might to do what it likes, where it likes, you know, it needs the sort of cloak of legitimacy, politically at least, that is conferred by going into this with a strong set of allies. Mm-hmm. The other question is, of course, you know, the Middle East is such a treacherous, mm-hmm. Duplicitous place. The idea that you can, by just supporting the Iraqi army and training rebels, if you can find moderate rebels mm-hmm. in Syria, you can get rid of ISIS with airstrikes. Mm-hmm. To me, it just seems like a huge long shot.
Well, Stephen raised the question, Tom, of the Iraqi army. And so far, we know there will be American air power used, and the Iraqi army will be supported. The Iraqi army, which has already yielded a third of Iraq to ISIS, and then the Kurdish army, which is smaller but more effective than and more reliable than the Iraqi army. This does not sound like the same kind of force which drove Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait and after 2003, the invasion of Iraq, which was also successful. In both of those cases, there were American troops on the ground. The president says there won't be any more.
Well, there will...
Combat troops.
Well, I mean, he's splitting hairs there. There will not be large-scale combat units, but certainly there will be a few hundred, maybe several hundred and maybe a few thousand American troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria. You cannot have a massive aerial campaign without American spotters, forward air controllers, and others on the ground helping to direct those strikes. So there will be American soldiers. There will be American combat soldiers in Iraq and probably ultimately Syria, but not in large numbers. The American people are just weary of 11 years of war here. The political stomach is not there for another ground campaign, even as American combat troops are winding down their engagement in Afghanistan as it is. So the real problem is, Stephen is right, the Iraqi army is pathetic. It's pitiful. I think in the not-too-distant future, someone's doing a serious history of these years, I think somebody will conclude, historians will conclude, that one of the biggest mistakes the U.S. government made in recent years was the decision to disband the Iraqi army after Saddam Hussein was removed from power by the Bush administration, because it wasn't a very good army, but it was an institution worth keeping in place, and it just fell apart. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't recovered, despite billions of dollars in training by the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion that they're going to carry the ball here and do most of the fighting is wishful thinking, at least at the moment.
Stephen, the president said a couple of things that I thought were unusual in his speech. He said, for instance, that ISIS, the Islamic State, is not Islamic. Well, they use Islamic in their title. Yeah, what was he getting at there?
I think what he was trying to do was maybe drive a wedge between ISIS and the rest of the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm.
He was, and that's all part of this idea of coalition building.
Mm-hmm.
He needs various Muslim states in the Middle East to sign up to this and help mm-hmm. him out. So he was trying to sort of make the point that ISIS is perhaps a perversion of Islam. It's mm-hmm. although it, you know, claims to be a jihadist Islamic army, it's really sort of operating more primitive, brutal, uncivilized methods. Another thing which he said I thought was interesting, he said he's going to destroy ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's possible to destroy ISIS. I mean, ISIS is an idea, and mm-hmm. after all, ISIS used to be called Al-Qaeda in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and apparently the U.S. government has already destroyed Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but what's really happened is that these groups changed their name. It's they talk about how they've destroyed core Al-Qaeda, but ISIS emerged from Al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
so you can destroy one group or one designation, mm-hmm. but getting rid of the sort of scourge of mm-hmm. radical jihadist Islam,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a political thing. The president has to say we're going to destroy it, because otherwise people are turned around and say, well, what's your goal? You're going to mm-hmm. try and manage it, but
mm-hmm.
effectively... Mm-hmm. You might be able to destroy and degrade and downgrade the threat from ISIS, but you can't destroy radical Islam, I don't think.
Well, destroy is a stronger word than he had used before when he had announced the earlier bombing. Another thing he said, Tom, I'll ask you this, is that the U.S. involvement was dependent on this new coalition government in Iraq. Well, it was just formed a few days ago. It's a very fragile enterprise, and it's durability is very much in question.
There's no doubt that the new government is inclusive, at least for the moment.
Yep.
On paper, you have all the various factions, including the Kurds, having a say in the government at the highest levels. But as you say, durability and stability are the key mm-hmm. words here. Now, the former Prime Minister Maliki was not effective. Let's mm-hmm. be as polite as we can about it. And the U.S. was basically saying to the Iraqi leadership, you have to get rid of Maliki. There has to be a new inclusive government, at least on paper, before we act. Well, now there is one. You're right. The durability is mm-hmm. another question to be determined. There's another irony here, I think, Fred. I mean, I share Stephen's skepticism about whether ISIS can actually be destroyed,
mm-hmm.
but if it can be destroyed, it's not going to happen on President Obama's watch. The irony here is the Obama administration came to power having to, in their view, mop up the end of an unpopular war left on their doorstep by former President Bush. Well, now, however this sorts out, this new war, and it is a war, or will be a war, is going to be left on the doorstep of the mm-hmm. next president for he or she to deal with. And you hear around the White House now people saying, well, we're going to be able to neutralize them to the point that it'll just be not that much of a problem mm-hmm. for the next administration. I think that's also wishful thinking.
Tom, do you think that ISIS can be defeated, destroyed, without American combat troops being a part of it?
No, I don't. I think the Iraqi military has proven to be timid and weak. I mean, the army just disintegrated when ISIS went into northern Iraq. I mean, and ISIS took over the key city of Mosul in the north, and the Iraqi army just fled. So I think if highly regarded generals, army generals like David Petraeus, who spent a lot of time and effort and billions of U.S. dollars in trying to train and equip the Iraqi military. If he couldn't do it, I don't see how anybody else is going to be able to do it. I think it's going to be difficult.
Let me ask you, Stephen, about a couple of countries that we know that a number of Arab countries signed on with President Obama in this effort. After a fashion, they said they would provide military support, I believe, if they want to, you know, and I forget the exact language. But there are two countries I'm particularly interested in. Egypt is one. Egypt has a large army. The Egyptians said, at least initially, that, well, their army's occupied. They're fighting the Muslim Brotherhood. And then you have Saudi Arabia, which does have an air force, among other things, American trained. So far, I think all we know is that the Saudis have agreed to, on their soil, to train Syrian rebels rebelling against the Assad regime in Syria. Beyond that, Jordan says it probably can't do anything. What can really realistically be expected from other countries in the Middle East?
I don't think publicly, at least, you're going to see a lot more than that. There are things that will be taking place behind the scenes. Intelligence cooperation with the Jordanians, mm-hmm. with the Saudis, with the sort of covert services in this region that would be perhaps able to sort of stem the flow of funds to ISIS, in so much as they're coming from outside the country. ISIS makes a lot of money by smuggling oil from the oil fields that it's captured on the black market, selling it in places like Iraq, Iran, etc. It's possible something could be done behind the scenes, but I don't think that you're going to see countries come out and, you know, full-throatedly endorse what the United States is doing. I think what the administration really wants is sort of the aura of cooperation, but it knows that it's going to have to do the bulk of the heavy lifting itself. And there's also, you know, it has to be said, skepticism in the region, first of all about this administration's Middle East policy, and generally the idea as well that here comes the United States again, once again trying to reshape the politics of the Middle East, create outcomes in the Middle East. And I think there's a lot of skepticism that A, the United States knows how to do it, and B, that it's committed in the long term.
Tom, what, in the broadest sense, what are the stakes here? You suggested just a minute or two ago that this war will still be going on when President Obama leaves as president in January 20th, 2017. My guess would be if the war is still going on and there's American bombing and ISIS hasn't been fully defeated by then, that war effort would be very unpopular by that point.
Well, I agree with you fundamentally, Fred. That's a long war, but I think the key is the level of American casualties. I've said before, mm-hmm. and I really believe it, that for the most part, America is a peaceful nation, but it is willing to support small little wars, so long as there are not large quantities of American servicemen and servicewomen dying. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the president's mantra of no combat boots on the ground is he knows that would drive up American casualties and that would complicate mm-hmm. his policy. Now, as he said in his speech, there are risks, and of course there are always risks. If this air campaign continues, there are likely to be American aircrew casualties, but probably not in huge numbers. The other problem is this is going to be costly. I think the President and Congress are talking about a $500 million emergency authorization for money to train and equip Syrian rebels, but this level of campaign is going to cost billions of dollars. And at some point, I think that's going to be problematic. So you're right. Mm-hmm. If this campaign continues, and ISIS has still got large chunks of territory in northern Iraq, and still has base camps in Syria that haven't been mm-hmm. knocked out, I think the popularity at the moment will abate. I think what has allowed the president to do this for the moment is are the horrendous beheadings of two American journalists. Yeah. That galvanized mm-hmm. public opinion mm-hmm. in the U.S. like nothing, I think, since the 9/11 bombings, mm-hmm. terror attacks in 2001. Hopefully, the Islamist militants will have figured that out and not behead any more European nationals because...
or at least videotape them.
Yeah, videotape them and flaunt them to the world. That's the quickest way to galvanize a coalition. But had that not happened, I think the president would have had a much harder time selling this air campaign.
Well, he's going to need some help from Republicans who he's been criticizing very harshly. And so far, they've agreed to help out in the beginning here. But getting the money is going to be something else. Stephen, before we take a break, what is really at stake here in this fight?
That's a good question.
For the United States in particular.
It's a good question. The fundamental thing that's at stake is U.S. security. I mean, no president can afford to sit there in the White House, watch a threat evolve in the post-9/11 era, and then have it come back to haunt him if there's some kind of terror attack on U.S. shores or U.S. interests. So I think the biggest fear that people talk about in the White House is the idea of these foreign fighters, many of them with European passports, some who are even Americans, who it wouldn't take much for one of them to come back here, stage even a, you know, a small-scale terror attack to really once again sort of revive all the kind of latent fears of terrorism, everything that, that sort of still there under the surface after 9/11. So I think that generally is the bottom line for the present.
Okay. I think we've exhausted that subject for today, but it will be a subject on the show for many months to come, I think. Anyway, we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes, of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Stephen Collinson of AFP, Tom DeFrank of National Journal, and this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Believe me, podcasts are becoming much more popular. We do them at the Weekly Standard and now at VOA. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Tom, when I learned of new sanctions agreed to by European and American officials on economic sanctions on Russia, there was sort of a deja vu quality. You know, we've been here before and the same things happen over again and Russia sort of steps back, Vladimir Putin, the other president steps back, and then he steps forward again. And I just wonder whether economic sanctions gradually escalated are really going to have an effect.
I don't think so, although you could argue, Fred, that there is less mischief in Ukraine at the moment. There are fewer Russian troops in Ukraine. The offensive of pro-Russian separatists seems to have been blunted to a point, but that doesn't necessarily mean much. That could just be Putin is trying to convey an aura of behaving, of being a little more careful, in hopes the sanctions will be rolled back. I mean, I thought one of the more interesting things that several European leaders and President Obama said in a statement last week, he said, "We were watching closely developments since the announcement of the ceasefire, but we have yet to see conclusive evidence that Russia has ceased its efforts to destabilize Ukraine." And then he said, "If Russia fully implements its commitments, these sanctions can be rolled back." And it almost was an acknowledgement that there is not a lot of stomach on the part of the Europeans to get tougher on Russia. And Putin, being a very calculating guy, he's probably figured that out. So if he, quote, behaves, I mean, I think Putin believes that the Europeans don't want to do this. They don't want to mess up their economies too much. They're dependent on oil. They're dependent on natural gas. And they're reluctant. They're reluctant sanctioners. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think it was a European Union official that said when they announced these new sanctions that they were reversible.
Right, right.
I sort of agree with Tom that when you start out by saying, well, you know, we can back off any time, and the idea, of course, is that if the Russians do the what the Europeans and Americans want, well, then they'll ease the sanctions. But saying that at the beginning is it doesn't seem to serve their own cause even.
Right. I mean, this is the problem of having a foreign policy on behalf of 30 nations. There's not even consensus among the Europeans about what to do. A lot of the southern European states are very concerned about the loss of billions of dollars of Russian money that washes through their economy. So the British, for example, London is, you know, the city of London is almost maintained by Russian businesses that have sort of left the climate in Moscow and, and gone to London. So the problem is, if you don't do sanctions, what do you do? There's no prospect that any of these European countries or United States sees enough of a national interest to go and use military force to support the Ukrainians. So, you know, we can criticize, and I think, you know, we criticize the president, but if it wasn't for U.S. pressure, I don't think we'd even be seeing the sanctions from Europe that we're seeing now. So it's, I think it's a question of, there's not actually a lot that the West can do, given the fact that Ukraine is not a NATO member, you know, to really stand up to President Putin. You know, he's a shrewd politician. He understands that pretty well.
One of the things the president said in his speech several days ago about accelerating the American effort and the war effort against the Islamic State in Iraq and even bombing in Syria, he said, "It is America that has rallied the world against Russian aggression and in support of the Ukrainian people's right to determine their own destiny." I thought that, Tom, was a bit of an overstatement, that the world has been rallied against Russian aggression.
Grandiose is being charitable, I think. That was a sweeping generalization, and it's not correct. I mean, I think the American people in polls show that they support sanctions against Russia, but they're not. The American public is not wholeheartedly embracing this, and I think that's a bit of a stretch.
Stephen, Scottish independence. We're depending on you on this. You told me before the show that you had gone to college in Scotland, and you had your first job in journalism was in Scotland. I'll have to say, as an American, I really don't understand this quest, other than the emotion behind it, but this quest for Scottish independence. What would Scotland get that it doesn't have now by being independent?
That's the crux of the campaign, and a lot of sort of outside observers say not very much. Everyone sees Scotland really as a nation already. I mean, there's a lot of doubt about what kind of fiscal price it would pay. It would the British, the rest of the United Kingdom says it couldn't use the pound. It would struggle to have a central bank. There's all sorts of complicated calculations that the separation of a 300-year-old political union would entail. I think how we've got here is the fact that for 22 of the last 35 years, Scots and the United Kingdom have been ruled by Conservative governments from London. At the same time, the Conservative Party has been wiped out as a political force in Scotland. In 1979, when Margaret Thatcher took power, there were 22 Conservative MPs in Scotland. Now there's one Conservative MP in Scotland. You know, there's an old joke that goes around that there's more pandas in Edinburgh Zoo than there are Conservative MPs in Scotland. And so the nationalist cause gathered pace because of that. And then when Tony Blair came in to power in 97, he saw this sort of the independence train running, and he decided that, okay, we should give Scotland more devolved powers. We should give them a parliament, more control over their own affairs. But that actually didn't stop the independence train. It accelerated it because it allowed the Scottish National Party to come into government. They actually run Scotland now. The First Minister, Alex Salmond, is a Scottish nationalist. And it made the image of Scotland as a separate political entity more cemented. So you're right, this is a real cliffhanger. There was a poll last week that put the Yes to Independence campaign up by several points. I think they might have crested. That poll sort of concentrated some minds and spread some panic in Westminster, but nobody really knows what's going to happen next week when this referendum takes place.
Well, I certainly don't. Tom, what's your take on it? You know, one of the things that's been sort of predicted is if the independence referendum passes, that this will stir nationalist groups, the Basques in Spain, and efforts to secede by groups to secede from other countries, particularly all over Europe.
Well, I think the Basques are probably not going to be able to secede from Spain, but the Flemish are already talking about separating from Belgium. I think it will give impetus. It'll just create a whole bunch of corollary complications for European governments. The key, I think, is going to be turnout. There are reports that turnout may be heavier than predicted, and usually that means when you have a heavy turnout, it means you have more committed voters, mm-hmm. and that bodes ill for the UK. On the other hand, it is somewhat breathtaking to believe mm-hmm. that this could happen. I think they're very nervous in London. It was almost comical that basically the entire top of the British government, from Prime Minister Cameron on down, kind of tore up their schedule in recent days mm-hmm. and descended on Scotland and promising more autonomy. And I think they're very worried. I mean, if the Yes movement wins, the only thing you can say for sure is it'll be an even greater mm-hmm. mess than we suspect at the moment.
How embarrassing would this be for the Cameron Conservative government if the Yes people win and Scotland becomes independent?
Well, David Cameron, he's the leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party.
Mm-hmm.
The whole raison d'etre of that party is the Union. Mm-hmm. He would go down as the Prime Minister, the first Prime Minister in 300 years that couldn't keep the Union together. I mean, that's not much of a legacy. And I think it's very likely that Cameron, who's already facing trouble from his right on the question of Europe, would face a leadership challenge before the next UK general election next year.
Could he survive that?
I think it's very doubtful.
I mean, based on the notion that Scotland did vote for independence.
Paradoxically, the fact that if Scotland voted for independence, it would be more difficult for the Labour Party to win a general election because Labour has 40 MPs in Scotland. So the Conservative cause, the Conservatives would probably win most general elections in the UK, but, you know, it's a dismembered UK.
Politics is so interesting, and not just in the U.S. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.